We've had quite a trip through some of the big topics of the scriptures over the last few weeks. We've covered, and of course, not comprehensively, but we've covered heaven and hell and angels and demons. And last week we talked about Satan. And this week we lighten it up a little bit and talk about the apocalypse and the end times. Not many people have opinions on this or thoughts about how exactly this goes, so it should be short this week. Of course, I'm kidding. But we're going to begin with three stories, a couple historical ones and one from my own experience. The first story is about a man named John Nelson Darby, and John Nelson Darby lived in the mid-1800s. And Darby was a guy who looked at the Bible and said, you know what, we need to figure this out. And John Nelson Darby started a way of reading the scriptures that's called dispensationalism. Dispensationalism hinges on a view that anyone reading the Bible can read this as simple as that chart right there. Right? Dispensationalism is supposed to be this really plain and simple reading. If you just read the Bible very literally, you'll come to that conclusion. Of course, no one had come to that conclusion for 150 years since the time of Jesus. Anyone can understand this. And this is how the end times, this is how Revelation, this is how we read Daniel and Revelation and all of these end times prophecies. If we just have this system, well, this is how we can figure it all out. The dates and the times and all of those things. And as the debates about how we read the Bible started to heat up in the early 1900s, dispensationalism was especially attractive to those who really wanted to take the Bible seriously. And they said, if we want to take the Bible seriously, we have to read it literally. And dispensationalism became not just one idea of how to read the scriptures or how to understand the end times. It became almost central to orthodoxy in many parts of the church. Unless you read it like this, you're a liberal who doesn't really care about the Bible, is almost the feel that you get. And in the mid-1900s, this way of reading the Bible went out into the public in new and captivating ways through Hal Lindsey's book, The Late Great Planet Earth. Anyone remember, familiar with The Late Great Planet Earth? Or how about this, Left Behind? Anyone heard of it? They were good enough books that they made a movie with Kirk Cameron out of it. So you know they're good. And here's the thing. They're really great books, like fun books. Not great literature, but they're fun books. I've read the first few at least, and they're page-turners, you know? But not always the greatest theology. Dispensationalism is also a favorite of televangelists. If you turn on the TV, you're very likely to find a TV preacher who reads the Bible in the way of John Nelson Darby. And central to the appeal of dispensationalism is the belief that the world is getting worse and worse and worse, and at some point it just can't get any worse, and then Jesus will return. So dispensationalism really rests in our fear that the world is getting worse. And so that's one of the prominent, most culturally prominent readings of the Bible that really originated only about 150, 160 years ago. Second story is about the book of Revelation itself. I don't know how many of you are super familiar with how we got the Bible that we have here, what books were included and what weren't, but most of the books in our New Testament, most of the books were widely agreed upon. These were the Gospels, many of Paul's letters. Everyone said, okay, these books are part of our scriptures. The church has been reading this. These scriptures have been shaping the life of the church for hundreds of years, but there were a few books that Christians around the 2nd, 3rd, 4th century weren't quite sure about. These were books that had an impact on the church and were read in many churches, but there were some concerns about them. Who wrote them? Where they were, why and where they were written, those kind of things. And one of those books that the church, early church, wasn't so sure about was Revelation. Now, the early church, the very early church, loved Revelation, and they used it. And it was an encouragement to them. But as time went on, people got a little more skeptical because they looked at Revelation and saw how already within the first couple hundred years, people were starting to take some of the images and symbols of Revelation and twist them into teachings that really didn't look much like Jesus. And so there was a concern, not that Revelation wasn't scripture or written by an apostle, but more that people might not really understand how to read it and it could do damage. Of course, that hasn't happened in 2,000 years. I kid, again. The last story is about my seminary experience. I had a professor named Grant Osborne, Dr. Grant Osborne. Side note, we actually watched the Ohio State play Florida in the national championship game with Grant Osborne. So for what that's worth, he was a really great guy. But I also had him for a class where we looked at the book of Revelation. Now, Dr. Osborne has written all kinds of commentaries on many books of the New Testament. But this is what he said to the class. He said, Revelation was the easiest one of all of them to write. Here's why. He said, because if you've read any of what we call intertestamental literature, the Jewish literature written between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament, if you've read any of that, if you've read the book of Daniel, if you know anything about Roman culture and symbols, it's really quite simple. Because the book of Revelation was meant to be meaningful and understandable to its first readers. And so if you think, 300 years from now, or let's go even farther, let's go 1,000 years from now, people might look back and see, the golden arches, or they might see some of these other symbols that we look at and we know exactly what they are, but 1,000 years from now, they might be like, oh, what is that? That's curious. What could that mean? Well, that's how Revelation is. Many of these symbols were directly meaningful and understandable to the first people who read and received the letter of Revelation. But over time, it's become more and more obscure the more distant we are from the culture, the more distant we are from those symbols. But Dr. Osborne said, once you understand the culture in which it was written, that's really not that complicated. He also incidentally said that Revelation is the only book he would discourage people from reading without a commentary, without help, for the reason I just mentioned. It is not understandable to the layperson unless you have some help on what these symbols mean. So beware. Those are my three stories. Let's get to our gospel text for the morning. It's from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 24, verses 36 through 34. This is Jesus speaking, and he says, "But about that day and hour, no one knows, neither the angels of heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. For as the days of Noah were, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day Noah entered the ark, and they knew nothing until the flood came and swept them all away, so too will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then two will be in the field, one will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding meal together, one will be taken and one will be left. Keep awake, therefore, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour." The Gospel of the Lord. Praise be to you, O Christ. Now, Matthew 24, what I've just read, is part of what many call the little apocalypse. It's not as long as the book of Revelation, but we have Jesus speaking in apocalyptic terms, speaking in symbols and images and concepts that are bigger than we might be able to wrap our minds around. But what we have to understand about, first of all, the word apocalypse is that it simply means an unveiling or an unwrapping. It means kind of tearing back the curtain so that we can see what's going on in the invisible realm, which we've talked about, angels and demons, all these things, the heavenly realms, so we can see what's going on there. And Jesus, in most of this little apocalypse, isn't really predicting the far end of time future as much as he's unveiling where the current path of his people will lead. It's almost like any of your parents or any of you parents have ever said, if you keep eating all of that candy, you're going to be sick. Any of you said that? He's like, I know. You maybe not don't know candy yet. But one day, you'll love it. But, you know, if you eat too much, you'll be sick. Now, if a parent says, you know, if you keep eating that candy, you're going to be sick. We don't think of that parent as this great prophet and predictor of the future, do we? It's just you're saying, okay, this is what you're doing, and we know where this story ends, basically. And for much of this little apocalypse, this is what Jesus is doing. He's saying, if you keep living in this way as Jewish people, intent on revolt and revenge against Rome, things are going to get ugly. And indeed, in the year 70 AD, the temple, the Romans came in and put down a Jewish rebellion, destroyed the temple, and it was a terrible experience. If you lived in Jerusalem at that point, if you were a Jew, but especially if you lived in Jerusalem at that point, it was an awful, life-crushing, end-of-the-world kind of experience. And much of what Jesus is talking about, and some of what we see in Revelation even, is really talking about that experience. Again, these texts were meaningful to the original readers, and if we understand some history, it opens up the scriptures in new ways. And this interpretation of much of what Jesus says is consistent with first-century Jewish thinking. Rob Bell says this. He says, when people talk about, do you think an apocalypse is coming? At least in Jewish history, he says, yeah, apocalypses, several have already happened. This is how they thought. These kind of end-of-the-world types of experiences where suffering just comes in a burst, like a bomb cyclone. These are apocalyptic experiences. These are end-of-the-world experiences. And they didn't necessarily look for one particular one, but the actual experience of suffering and religious, just everything blowing up in real life. They'd already experienced that. And so, even more so, when we look at verse 36, we should be moved to humility, right? Whether Jesus is talking about the destruction of the temple or if he's talking about the end time, but about that day and hour, no one knows. Neither angels of heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. Should we not read this word and have some level of humility when we ask questions about the details of the end times? I've said this before, and I could say it again many times. When the scriptures talk about the future, they are not predicting events as much as they are preparing people. And we see very clearly that this is what Jesus is doing. Look again at verse 43 and 44. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour. Jesus is saying, live in light of this ultimate truth. You don't know when the Son of Man is coming back. So live like it could be any time. Be ready for when that moment comes. Let's get to Revelation. You ready? You ready for this? Revelation. Now again, I want to go back to what Dr. Osborne said, that this text was meaningful to its original readers. They weren't thinking, oh, maybe in 2,000 years, this and this and this will happen. It was meaningful to them in their context. So Revelation is about, essentially about the challenge of living as a follower of the crucified Lamb of God, within an empire that believes in using crosses, not carrying them or dying on them. An empire that demanded allegiance, honor, obedience, or else. And it's talking to people who are in this situation, who are living in this empire, and were being kind of demanded to go to the temple of the goddess Roma, the goddess of Rome, that of the empire. Go to the temple of the emperor, of the Caesar, and pay your homage, give your offerings, do all these things. And you have people who are saying, man, it could get uncomfortable. I mean, I'm a Christian, but it could get uncomfortable if I don't play the game. If I don't pledge my allegiance to the empire, if I don't play along and give offerings at the empire's shrine, and they're thinking, well, maybe I can just kind of play along with this. I don't believe in this, but maybe I can just play along and just have it both ways. I can go to the shrines and do my good duty as a Roman citizen, but really I'm worshiping Jesus over here. And these are the things that these early Christians in the Roman Empire are asking and thinking. And Revelation is a warning that says, if you do that, you're playing a dangerous game. You're living a double life. Don't get too tangled up in this thing that's going to end up in the lake of fire one day. Don't get too tangled up in the ways of the empire. That's the warning of Revelation to these early Christians. But Revelation is also an encouragement to those who are living in the kingdom and saying, it says, continue in the way of God's kingdom because this is what endures forever. This is what will one day be manifest in its fullness. Keep doing those things. Keep following Jesus, even if it seems like you're on the losing team right now. And the beauty of Revelation is that it speaks to these early Christians, first Christians living in the Roman Empire, and it does it with symbols and allusions that draw us back out. And so when we read the text of Revelation, it is about those Christians living in Rome, but it's not just to and about those Christians. The symbols draw us out and speaks to the other stories, the other experiences that Christians and the Jewish people had and that they will have in the future. That's what the apocalyptic symbols and images do for us. So the Christians in Rome are like the Hebrew slaves in Egypt, who were like the exiles in Babylon, who were like the Holy Family, Joseph and Mary and Jesus, under the reign of Herod when he's going to kill him. They're all connected by these symbols and by these images. Revelation reveals the cycle of history, and it drills little by little into the depth of corruption and suffering that is life in this world. And it says this cycle will end with a new heaven and a new earth coming together once and for all. Trying to summarize the book of Revelation in like 5 minutes is a really difficult task. But what I hope you see, can we go up one slide or one click? There we go. So this is, again, Revelation is written to very specifically the Christians in Rome, but the symbols and allusions draw us out so that we can see our story, so that we can see the story of persecution and suffering that exists in all times and places in their story, and be warned and encouraged in the same ways that they were warned and encouraged. So those are just a couple examples of situations where they might need to hear the message of Revelation. So let's get to the end. Let's get to the end of the story. Because again, Revelation is the story of human history. Not just one specific event, or even chronologically one event after another. It's just the story of humanity. This is how the world has been and will continue to be until the end. But here's what it says at the end. And we're going to look at Revelation 20. And we're going to go verse by verse for the chapter and see what's going on here. Revelation 20, verses 1 through 3. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain. He seized the dragon, that ancient serpent who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years and threw him into the pit and locked and sealed it over him so that he would deceive the nations no more until 1,000 years were ended. After that, he must be let out for a little while. What's going on here? First of all, this is a heavenly scene. This is a behind-the-curtain scene, right? We're talking about angels. We're talking about Satan, right? We're talking about things that we can't see. And it actually connects to Revelation 12, which we read at the very beginning of the series, where Satan is thrown out of heaven with his followers and all of this, right? And so the question here is, what happens with the coming of Christ and as a result of his death and resurrection? We're getting a picture of what Christ has done to defeat Satan. What about the 1,000 years? And this is a point of lots of debate. Well, again, in this book, there are symbols and images from beginning to end. 1,000 years is a symbolic number. It's a complete period of time. And I would suggest it's referring to the age of the church. I'll show you why that is in just a minute. The age of the church. From the time of Jesus' resurrection, or I should say from the time of Pentecost until now, that's the 1,000 years. Well, then you say, well, what about Satan? Satan's not bound, right? How can this be the 1,000 years if Satan is bound? Well, I'll say this. Jesus, when he walked around, talked about binding Satan. That's exactly what he was doing. And it says, why was Satan bound? He was bound so that he would deceive the nations no more. Doesn't that sound in some way like the church age? That God had revealed himself to the people of Israel, but the nations had still been deceived. But now in the age of the church, the gospel goes out to all the nations of the world, because they are no longer deceived by Satan. All right, so this is the heavenly scene. This is a picture in three verses of the last 2,000 or so years of human history. Let's go to the earthly scene, which is verses 4 through 6. Then I saw thrones, and those seated on them were given authority to judge. I also saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their testimony to Jesus and for the word of God. They had not worshipped the beast or its image and had not received its mark on their foreheads or their hands. They came to life and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. Right? See that 1,000 years again. It's the same scene. Verses 1 through 3 and 4 through 6. The same 1,000-year scene. The rest of the dead did not come to life until 1,000 years were ended. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy are those who share in the first resurrection. Over these, the second death has no power, but they will be priests of God and of Christ, and they will reign with him for 1,000 years. Again, this is an earthly view of the same scene, of the saints on earth living out what has been shown to us from heaven. It is those who believe that, who are faithful, who believe that the Lamb is worthy of their worship. And the New Testament talks about us as priests and kings, as those who have already been raised with Christ and who now are priests and kings in this world, who reign as Christ, as his image bearers on this earth. The New Testament testimony of Christians was that as Christ reigns in the heaven as the eternal King and the great high priest, we incarnate and embody his reign on earth as the Spirit restores us in the image of Christ. So the age of the church is the age in which we reign on the earth during this period. Again, it doesn't always look like it, does it? Martyrdom. Suffering. But where did Christ reign from? A cross. We reign as Christ reigned in sacrificial and self-giving love over the world. We go back to a heavenly scene, verses 7 through 10. When the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations at the four corners of the earth. Gog and Magog. Those are old Testament images we're not going to get into today. In order to gather them for battle, they are as numerous as the sands of the sea. They marched up over the breadth of the earth, surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city, and fire came down from heaven and consumed them. And the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur, where the beast and the false prophet were, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. This is the heavenly scene of judgment on the spiritual forces of evil. That they have done their best, but there really isn't much of a battle, is there? They're just defeated and thrown into the lake of fire. It's the final judgment of the evil powers. As we talked about last week, that Satan is the liar and the tempter and the accuser. This is the end of lying and temptation and accusation. And finally, the same scene, but now the earthly view. What's going on earth? Well, this is happening in heaven. Then I saw a great white throne and the one who sat on it. The earth and the heaven fled from his presence, and no place was found for them. And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and books were opened. Also another book was opened, the book of life, and the dead were judged according to their works, as recorded in the books. And the sea gave up the dead that were in it. Death and Hades gave up the dead that were in them. And all were judged according to what they had done. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. Just stop. The end of death. That's the end of death. And Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death, the lake of fire. And anyone whose name was not found written in the book of life was thrown into the lake of fire. So just as the evil powers have been judged, now is the judgment of all humanity. It's that moment, as we've talked through the series, when all is brought to light and all is exposed. And the question that we are to ask right now is, what will our life show when all is brought to light and all is exposed? Not what do people know about us now, or what can we get away with now, but when God looks at our lives, when all is brought out into the open, what will be seen? Will it show a testimony to the worthiness of the Lamb and to the way of Christ? Or will it show testimony to the worthiness of the empire and the ways of violence, oppression, and deception? That's the question Revelation brings to us now. Okay, we have these choices before us. What will we choose now, knowing that in the end, the empire, the beast, the liar, and the deceiver are thrown into the lake of fire? And we know that love and faith and hope continue on into eternity. How will we live now? The point is to see how this all ends. Not the dates and times, but the ultimate enduring nature of God's kingdom. And that we are now then called to live with faith in the way of the cross, to live with hope in the great reversal where blessed are the poor, live with the love that overcomes and endures forever. This text is about the expulsion of evil and the ultimate reign of good. The hows and the whens and the wheres and even the details of the whos are not the point. The point is to unveil what is not always clear to us on a daily basis when we look around. That faith, hope, and love abide and lead to life and are victorious. And that greed and violence and self-centeredness lead to death and will ultimately be banished. And so, this text, this whole book of Revelation is about Rome, but it's about all powerful human empires that seek to dominate and achieve peace by fear and by violence. It's about the persecuted first century Christians, but it's about all those who suffer and die for walking in the way of Christ's love. It's about Emperor Nero or Domitian. There's debate about when exactly it was written. But it's about all arrogant leaders who use their authority to build themselves up by using and slandering and destroying others. And so as you read Revelation, you hear the story of Moses and Pharaoh and the oppression of Egypt, and the story of Babylon and the destruction of the temple during Jeremiah's ministry. And you hear the story of Herod and Mary and Jesus and the massacre of the innocents. And you hear the story of Pilate and Caiaphas and the cross on which Jesus died. And you hear the story of the early Christians trying to keep their heads above water when the values of the empire seem like a flood overwhelming them. And so, it's no wonder that readers have also heard their own stories of suffering and oppression in the text as well. That's how it's meant to be read. The problem is when we try to figure out exactly when and where and whom this story is about, because the answer to those questions is yes. It's about all of these experiences. It's about all of our dilemmas of how do we follow Christ in this place, with these temptations, with these struggles. And when we ask when the apocalypse is coming, it has come. In the temple's destruction in 70 AD, and with the persecutions that decimated the early Christian communities, and with the plagues in Europe and in Africa and beyond, and with the Holocaust, and with Hiroshima, and two world wars, and Vietnam, and with 9/11. These events felt like the end of the world to the people who lived through them, and these are the people who need to hear that God is with them, and that God is still reigning, and that it will not always be this way because Christ is making all things new. And indeed, it is also what we need to hear when we find ourselves cozying up to the empire and the ways of Pharaoh. When we find prosperity and power alluring, and when we become okay with benefiting in this life at the expense of slaves, or at the expense of underpaid workers, or at the expense of impoverished nations around us, or at the expense of the planet itself, we need to hear these words. It's not worth it. Because it's all getting thrown into the lake of fire. And if you're clinging to it, there's no guarantees. It's not worth it because only the Lamb is worthy. Only the Lamb who has been slain is worthy to open the final scroll of history, is only the one who's only worthy to anoint kings and priests in this world and to receive power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing. Only the Lamb is worthy of your life. We all need to hear the Spirit and the Bride say, come, drink the water of life. Because none of us know when and where and how exactly it will all pan out, because that's not what the Bible is trying to tell us. The Bible is saying, be prepared. When you tear back the veil, the powers and systems that seem to be winning have been destroyed on the cross, and all that seems to be weak and forgotten is being renewed in glory. The end times are really a new beginning, a new creation completely and finally shaped like the life of Jesus Christ, by grace, by truth, and love, world without end. Amen.